my guys are still under a judicial estrangement order. That blue thing I got from her.
I've got the best lawyer soft tacos can buy.
Objection.
On what grounds?
How about silliness, Your Honor?
I think legal terms are magic words that can force people to do what I want.
My client has instructed me to remind the court how rich and important he is, and that he is not like other men.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 422. I'm Thomas Smith. That's Andrew Torres. How you doing, sir?
I am fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
You know, I'm glad you're fantastic. We all need that. But I'm looking at the agenda for today here on the spreadsheet that you call the whiteboard.
I mean, we live in a dystopian hellscape.
Oh, my God. But, yeah, I was just going to say, like, this is, if going into, like, you know, October 2016, someone had been like, oh, this will be the podcast agenda when Trump is president, I'd be like, well, okay, that's a little much. Like, I'm not sure. Yeah. We got sedition, we got forced hysterectomies, a little that we can't do, don't have time for the eugenics deep dive, everybody, but we'll kind of preview that one. Bill Barr charging protesters with sedition and like subversion. I mean, this is just, yeah, let's get into the hellscape, shall we, Andrew? Before we get to our main segment, we did want to, I guess, sort of preview the eugenics and just awful. Tell us, give us the preview there, the upcoming deep dive.
Yeah. This story is incredibly disturbing. And as I started to vet it, so here is the report. The story is that ICE is engaging in forced hysterectomies, that is, sterilizing women who have been detained at the border. Now, I saw that break in the news and I thought, okay, you know, even for as bad as Trump is and everything else.
I would really like this to not be real. That would be nice if it was fake news.
I thought it was going to be, I sort of pegged it for an A segment of, okay, like there's bad stuff and there's terrible conditions. That's not the case. There is a 27-page complaint filed by Project South, the Institution for the Elimination of Poverty and Genocide. These are real lawyers from a real organization. The allegations are serious and disturbing, and it needs a deep dive and a full analysis, which we will do. That was filed a couple of days ago, this Monday, September 14th. And I promise you that we will break it down. So far, ICE has issued blanket denials, but like not super encouraging blanket denials. And the allegations, like I said, are incredibly specific.
Yeah, is this like a whistleblower situation?
It is. Yeah, there is a whistleblower nurse. Her name is Dawn Wooten. And she was employed at one of the detention centers in Georgia, which, of course, is operated by a private prison company. And so she is now cooperating with outside counsel. And the allegations that she makes are terrifying and disturbing, right? That the center uses an outside gynecologist and that everybody or almost everybody he sees, here, let me quote Wooten from the complaint, quote, everybody he sees has a hysterectomy. Just about everybody. Everybody's uterus cannot be that bad.
Wow.
We've questioned among ourselves, like, goodness. He's taking everybody's stuff out. That's his specialty. He's the uterus collector. I know that's ugly. Is he collecting these things or something? Everybody he sees, he's taking all their uteruses out or he's taking their tubes out. What in the world? Everything I just said is a direct quote from the complaint. And so it is, like I said, the allegations are terrible and disturbing. And I promise you we will go over them in detail. It needs more than an A segment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely, for sure. Also, good on this whistleblower. Thank you for not waiting and making this your upcoming book that you're going to sell in 6 months. I appreciate you, you know, being a good whistleblower. We need more brave people like this nurse. Wow. Okay. Well, it doesn't get much worse. We have to do a show and all that, but wow, this is hard. I'm not going to joke. There's no spin. Let's just move on, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're on to the E. Jean Carroll topic. This is an Andrew was right and Andrew was wrong. Update us.
But really, this is just doing a further dive into that story because I am happy with the analysis we did on the story last week. And I've now had a chance, thanks to the crowdsourcing we did, to follow up on some of the threads that are out there. A couple of questions that we left in the air. The first was our position that we took that said, you know, the subject matter argument is probably correct, right? That the president answering questions from reporters and denying that he had ever raped a woman is probably within the scope of his duties. So the subject matter of answering reporters' questions about non-governmental conduct, i.e., did you rape this woman in a department store, probably are going to be considered within the scope of his authority. And an anonymous listener pointed me to the case of Kerr versus Ballinger, which is a case from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. And it involved a North Carolina representative named Cass Ballinger. And the local newspaper, the Charlotte Observer, was doing a puff piece on him, right? And so then the journalist got a letter and the reader said, hey, you did this puff piece on Camp Ballinger. Why didn't you point out that he's separated from his wife, right? Hmm. And the reporter, Tim Funk, said, okay, all right, I'll go check it out. So then he called Ballinger's office and said, hey, I just want to follow up on our piece. Got a, you know, tough follow-up question to ask you. And in that follow-up, Ballinger said the following. He said, I wanted to reach out to clarify some and give some answers with respect to the question of whether I am separated from my wife. I am. It was like a 15-minute call, according to the lawsuit. And he said, look, my wife is really unhappy that my apartment in Washington, D.C., right? Because, you know, you maintain your own residence back in North Carolina, and then you say, oh, I'm going to keep, you know, an apartment in Washington, D.C. to live down there. His apartment was across the street from the headquarters of CAIR, C-A-I-R, the Council on American Islamic Relations. Now, Council on American Islamic Relations.
What does that have to do with any of this story?
Okay. Yeah, well, here's what it has to do. We're getting there, I promise. Yeah. Right? So CAIR is a nonprofit, and their goal is to promote positive images of Islam in the United States.
Yeah.
And totally. You know, you might agree or disagree with some of the stuff they have to say. Ballinger said, CAIR is, quote, the fundraising arm for Hezbollah.
Oh, God.
That's not true. Obviously, Hezbollah is a foreign terrorist organization. It has been so designated by the U.S. Department of State. And CAIR sued Ballinger, and rightly so, for defaming them, for calling them the fundraising arm of Hezbollah. So the lawsuit was about whether Ballinger's statement regarding CAIR fell under the protections. Yeah, exactly.
I guess I missed. So what was the connection between the separation and the marriage?
Yeah, like, he said, I separated from my wife because she was unhappy with the fact that my apartment in Washington, D.C. is across the street from the headquarters for CARE. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. That sounds plausible. That's yeah, what I like, would say, too. Well, she just is so anti-Islam or something. She's such an Islamophobe that that had nothing to do with likely all the affairs he was having or something.
I
don't want to defame him. That's a joke. Just kidding.
But yeah, like it, the idea that being separated from his wife would be a terrible, would be a story that has to be corrected. But, you know, being a racist idiot would not be a story that.
Oh, yeah. Well, that part corrected. I find believable. It's his story about what happened. So, okay. So is this awful racism and defamatory speech part of his political job, I guess.
Right. And so the question is, right, this is the Westfall Act that we discussed last week. And so the question is saying racist stuff about CARE part of his job? And the D.C. Circuit said, yes. Yes, it is. Because CARE said,
are you a Republican? Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's part of your job.
And CARE made the argument under exactly the same standards that I predicted they would make the argument under. So I feel good about this. That Ballinger's statement was, quote, not actuated even in part to serve the master, end of quote. Right. So they used, if you recall, that's the same restatement provision that I said, you know, this is probably what we're going to talk about being in the scope of your employment. We're going to have to look at, you know, is it intended to serve the master, which in the case of an elected official means serve the voting public. And the D.C. Circuit said yes, right? Ballinger followed up with the journalist to, quote, diffuse an issue that could affect his representational abilities to his district and or inhibit his long-term ability to continue advancing his legislative agenda in Congress. We agree with the district court that this conduct was motivated by a legitimate desire to discharge his duty as a congressman, as a member of Congress. And so, and then the court analytically says a member's ability to do his job as a legislator effectively is tied, as in this case, to the member's relationship with the public and in particular his constituents and colleagues in Congress. So I think that makes it abundantly clear that on subject matter grounds, right, the president answering hostile questions from a journalist about having raped a woman in a, I don't want to get too much into the details. Obviously, we talked about that last week, and it probably is within the scope of his employment. Mm-hmm. So then the question becomes, were we right on the waiver stuff? And here, this is where spoiler alert, I think we're 100% correct on the waiver grounds. I'm going to explain that in a minute. I said the default rule, I didn't know of a reason why the default rule on removal would not apply. There is a reason why the default rule on removal would not apply.
Are we talking about the timing issue now?
The timing issue. Okay. Yes, exactly.
And this was where you had said, seems like the judge is going to say, no way, way too late for this. You're kind of double dipping sort of thing. Like you tried it once and now you're going to try to remove it to federal court. And you're saying, you said originally you didn't think that would fly.
Yeah, that there was there's a clear 30-day deadline in the removal statute. So within the statute is a presumptive 30-day deadline. And I describe my experiences with that deadline and that the courts are very, very strict about that. Well, I'm not surprised that subsection D2 of the law, as I pointed out, there are not a lot of cases that analyze this. There's language in the statute itself that says any civil action shall be removed without bond at any time before trial by the Attorney General to the District Court of the U.S. States for the District and Division, embracing the place and the action in which the proceeding is pending. So the question is, does that supersede, right? Does that general, you can remove this at any time, supersede the more specific requirements of the removal statute generally? And after looking at the case law, I'm convinced that it does, but I'm convinced that it does for a particular reason, right? And that particular reason is this entire act, the Westfall Act, is triggered by the attorney general looking at a case, right? You send the case to the attorney general and the attorney general looks at it and goes, oh yeah, right, you're a federal employee, particularly if you're a low-level federal employee. And we think this is definitely the kind of lawsuit that Congress intended to immunize it, in the Westfall Act. And you could imagine, you know, with a busy attorney general who's not busy spending all his days thinking about how to jail protesters, spoiler for the next segment, right? That could take, right? You wouldn't want to say you've waived your right because the attorney general took too long to review this case, right? If you were a low-level government employee. So all of the cases that I have found that have allowed the timeliness to extend beyond 30 days are still governed. So that's the part we asked, I flagged, I said, seems like there's a hard 30-day cap. Listeners, anonymous listeners pointed me to this provision, 28 U.S.C. 2679 D2. And I went, researched, found that the application of that does indeed supersede the more general application of the 30-day timeline. But in all of those, in literally all of the cases that I saw, right, which again, only four or five, but there aren't a lot of cases on this, that they all involved cases in which the action was removed. For example, the one that I'm about to discuss, the Roskin versus Morgan Stanley case, the case was filed in November and then removed in February, right? And presumably the attorney general was probably busy in the month of December, right, over the holidays. So all of it are examples where, remember, the Westfall Act doesn't just protect the president, it protects low-level executive branch employees, right? It's designed to ensure that when you're actually doing your job, you don't wind up getting sued for that. And you wouldn't want them to lose their right just because the attorney general took a long Christmas break. So that makes total sense. But the larger question of, notwithstanding the clear, okay, you had 30 days, all right, maybe you get 2 months. Maybe you get a reasonable period of time, which could include at any time before trial, right? But the question is, can you waive, as a private litigant, your right under the Westfall Act to have the government step in and take over the case? And that, I still think, is a very clear and unambiguous yes, right? Huh. And the way in which that happens is what we said last week, right? Which is, when you act in a way that is inconsistent with your right to insist that this case be litigated in federal court, you can waive your right to remove the case to federal court. And the key case on this is a case called Fain versus Biltmore Securities, 166 FRD 39. Unfortunately, there's no publicly available version of the case, but it's a 1996 decision from the Middle District of Alabama. And it is the clearest articulation of the principles, which is, okay, if there's some kind of activity on the docket at the state court level, is that inconsistent with your right to litigate, right? Because in that case, what happened was a party was sued and they first filed a motion to stay the case pending arbitration, and then they removed the case to federal district court. And in federal district court, the plaintiffs argued the same thing that I said E. Jean Carroll is going to argue here. Like, oh, wait a minute. Like, you asked this court to stay pending arbitration. You can't then turn around and ask a federal court to do the same thing. And as it turns out, in the Fain case, the court said, no, this is okay, right? Filing a motion to stay pending arbitration was not inconsistent with the right to litigate in federal court, because they did that just sort of as a matter of course without investigating the jurisdictional issues, and they didn't get a ruling from the state court. And so here's how the federal court analyzed the issue. They said, when you litigate in state court and then remove to federal court, is that removal designed to preserve the status quo, that is, to protect your existing rights, or are you litigating on the merits? Do you have something you didn't like about what the state court did, and now you want another bite at the apple in federal court? That's the test. It is, did you manifest an intent to litigate in state court? And the Fain case was distinguishing an earlier case that remanded back to state court, said this is an improper removal because you already litigated a whole bunch of stuff in state court. And I will tell you, having being very, very familiar with those cases more generally, I think, like I said, there are 117 docket entries, including a year and a half back and forth litigating a motion to stay pending the summer Zervos outcome, which, unlike kind of the technical motion that was at issue in the Fain case, was deeply tied into the facts of the case, had numerous supporting exhibits on both sides, and most damningly, the Trump administration waited until they lost in state court and then came up with this theory and then removed. Yeah. So I stand by everything I said in the episode. The hard 30 days, right, is going to be superseded by that subsection D2. So, and I flagged that. I said, it's possible that there's a reason to supersede that. Turns out there is. But I was wrong in saying that it's a hard 30 days. I own up to that.
But you think the judge could still say no because of it's unreasonable what we're doing here?
I think absolutely that is what will happen. Nice. So procedurally, now, and this is not, I'm not just trying to rehab my image on the 30-day thing. procedurally, that there is another 30-day window, and that is the statute that governs what happens next is 28 U.S.C. section 1447. Again, I know this as somebody who sometimes moves to remand cases back down to state court. And subsection C says a motion to remand the case on the basis of any defect other than the lack of subject matter jurisdiction must be made within 30 days after the filing of notice removal. So E. Jean Carroll and her lawyers, who are exceptional lawyers, they're on top of this. I've actually tweeted at them. They haven't responded yet, but we'll see. They know they've got 30 days to object to this notice of removal, and their waiver claim is super duper strong here. And I would be shocked and delightfully, right? You didn't ask this question. You might have. I'm anticipating heading it off. Subsection D says an order remanding the case to the state court from which it was removed is not reviewable on appeal or otherwise, except that an order remanding pursuant to sections that aren't appropriate here shall be reviewable by appeal.
Does that cut both ways, though? If we get the wrong outcome here, it's like we don't have any recourse.
No, it only cuts again. Right. It says an order remanding which it was removed. So if this federal judge, who has already stricken USA from the caption and seems super skeptical of this case, if this judge says, yeah, that remand, that removal. Right. And remember, you remove from state court to federal court, you remand from federal court back to state court. Remand is right. Going back. Removal is what you do as the litigant. So if the judge says that removal was improper and remands it back to the state court, there is nothing Trump can do at that point. I mean, he can try and file for, petition for mandamus or whatever, but the you don't get more clear than X is not reviewable appeal or otherwise. Total eclair, exactly.
Quick question. I know we likely have to get to other things, but just to clarify, if, let's say worst case scenario, somehow you're wrong on this, that doesn't mean that Trump just gets off free, right? It's just that the government handles his defense, or is it really true that if this is determined that it's part of his job, then he's just can do whatever?
Sadly, it is the latter. If the Westfall Act applies, then Trump was acting in an official capacity when he allegedly defamed E. Jean Carroll. And then the party defending that is now the United States of America, and E. Jean Carroll's remedies run to the United States of America and not to Donald Trump personally. Wow. So But let's be clear on that.
Does that mean taxpayers could potentially be paying her a settlement or something?
Correct. And as you point out, that is exactly what would happen. The Westfall Act empowers the attorney general to settle these cases, and the case would settle. You and I, the taxpayers, would pay a ton of money to E. Jean Carroll to settle her claims for defamation, because there's no way you would litigate it, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, you might want to ask Uncle Frank how he feels about tax debt. Like, okay, maybe he's fine with Donald Trump paying $130,000 to silence Stormy Daniels. Is he fine with himself paying to silence E. Jean Carroll? Because that's what's going to happen. So, so literally everything hinges on the question of whether the court remands or not. I still think the argument is exceptionally good on waiver, and there is case law that says you can waive your right to remove to federal court. I cited it. It's the exact standard that we discussed last week. So there you go.
All right. Well, here's hoping for a good court thingy, because that's some BS.
Yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and say that was our slightly good news for the day, at least slightly yes. optimistic story. Now we get to the not that, which is what in the world? Bill Barr is just an unhinged Fox News, I guess, Kool-Aid drinker or whatever, because it seems as though he went on some rant about charging protesters with sedition. Okay, give us the breakdown, Andrew. What's happening? Do we need to be worried about this? Is there any realistic chance of this happening? All those questions and more.
Ultimately, we're going to do an OA-style deep dive here, and there's going to be a lot of terrifying stuff along the way. Ultimately, I think we get to a happy ending, but I want to flag some real landmines, and I want to start with, first, yes, Bill Barr said this, and it is absolutely terrible. I'm going to link the Wall Street Journal story in the show notes. It is absolutely terrifying that William Barr has said federal prosecutors should be looking to charge protesters. And keep in mind, he said two things, right? He said, I want you to bypass charges of vandalism or curfew violation and go straight for attempting to overthrow the government, which is the charge of sedition, potentially also the charge of subversion. I'm going to talk about the history of those two laws in this country in the 20th century forward, right? Like, I'm not going to go, there's not a hardcore history, man. I'm not going to go all the way back to like the Alien and Sedition Acts. And
you better be glad it's not hardcore history. Otherwise, we'd put out a 5-hour episode once every nine months or so.
Yeah. Instead, what we do is we put out 5 hours of content pretty much every week. But, you know, okay. So first, Barr said this, and even though his prosecutors are going to tell him to go clown horn himself for the reasons that I describe, and nobody is ever going to get charged, and certainly no one will ever be convicted, saying things as an official government policy has a chilling effect. Right. This is one of the most well-established First Amendment doctrines in our nation's history. Right. When the government says they're going to come after you, it is very little comfort to somebody to say, well, you know, if they do and you fight them in court, like, you're probably going to win. Like, people will just say, I'm super not interested in fighting this in court. Right.
Going against the U.S. government, where the stakes are pretty high.
Yeah, exactly, right? So that's the first point. He said it. Now, let's look at those two charges. First, subversion. And subversion is recognized as a crime in many European nations. In the United States, it is engaging in subversive activities. And the history of modern charges.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, I mean, I'm sure we can look back, if we're looking at history, we can look back to the Tea Party movement in early Obama years, because I'm sure we would have done the same thing to the white protesters that we do. So is there case law history of this back then?
Shockingly, no.
No? Oh, wow. What is the difference, I wonder?
So the difference is this is something in our nation's history that has always, and again, you and I are, you know, left of center, everything. I want to be 100% clear about this. The history of efforts to criminalize subversive activities in the past century in this country have exclusively been directed at left-wing voices and have never been directed at right-wing voices. And you are correct to point out that as actual right-wing terrorists commit actual crimes against the government, when Barack Obama instructed the FBI to take a look at, you know, actual terrorists committing actual crimes, that was considered a scandal by Fox News and has been ignored and encouraged by the current administration. So we're going to start off with Harry Bridges. Racehorse Harry, as he was. I love like old timey nicknames.
I hope there's no like racist connotation behind it, though.
He was an Australian guy, and he liked going to the track. And there were lots of labor unions. There were lots of labor union leaders named Harry. Just at reminds the time.
Me, is it the Simpsons boxing episode where everyone's named Boxcar? Like every opponent.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Opening Arguments is brought to you by BetterHelp. Folks, is there something interfering with your happiness or is preventing you from achieving your goals? I can't even ask that with a straight face. Things are rough lately. There's no sense in hiding the fact that things are rough and that a lot of people are not doing well. But here's the thing. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. I cannot recommend this enough. You can start communicating in under 48 hours. Now, this is not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online. There is a broad range of expertise available, which may not be locally available in many areas. The service is available for clients worldwide. You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room as with traditional therapy. Not to mention, you know, it's COVID. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed. It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. So many people love BetterHelp that they have left a tremendous amount of positive reviews and testimonials. I'm going to read you one right now. This review was written about a counselor named Abby. It says, "Abby has been amazing. She is always available when I need her. Even in my darkest moments, she has helped me overcome and feel good. I really don't know what I would have done without her." So visit BetterHelp.com/OA. That's BetterHelp. And join the over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. One more time, the special offer for Opening Arguments listeners is to get 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/OA.
Yeah, so there were lots of guys named Harry. So, and this guy was, you know, he was sometimes called Limey Harry because Americans in the 1930s and 1940s couldn't differentiate between British and Australians. But the non-racist nickname he got was Racehorse Harry because he liked going to the racetrack. All right. He was an Australian-born immigrant. He was ultimately naturalized in 1945, and he is a hero. He was he led massive strikes in the 1930s, 1940s. He was also a member of the Communist Party, and spent his entire active adult life in the United States agitating for workers' rights. And right wingers wanted to deport him. And so in 1940, they passed a law called the Smith Act, which was also called the Alien Registration Act of 1940. I will point out, A, that is before World War II, and B, that this was signed into law by, you know, liberal U.S. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It was then codified at 8 U.S.C. 10, and it criminalized subversive activities with fines or imprisonment for up to 20 years, denial of federal employment for 5 years, and deportation for immigrants, right? So the idea was that you would get Bridges would violate this law, you'd arrest him, and then you would deport him, get him out of the United States, away from causing trouble. And it says, in relevant part, it shall be unlawful for any person to knowingly or willfully advocate, abet, advise, or teach the duty, necessity, desirability, or propriety of overthrowing or destroying any government of the United States by force or violence, or by the assassination of any officer of such government. There's other stuff. You might be thinking, all right, so I get it. This kind of, you know, 1940 law, you know, what wasn't it repealed? It was moved to a different. Yeah, it was repealed because it was moved to a different section of the United States Court. It is still on the books today as 18 USC section 2385 with the same language. So you might be thinking, criminalizing, advocating, overthrowing the U.S. government, that seems like that would violate the First Amendment.
You would think so, yeah.
I'll say right here on the air, like, I don't believe this. I'm a fan of democracy. But, like, suppose I were to say on the air, like, I've said it before and I'll say it again. Democracy just doesn't work. We need to abolish democratic elections in this country and replace it with a philosopher king selected from a tripartite panel consisting of you.
Selected from any of the people in the Philosophers in Space Facebook group,
I think. I was going to say you, me, and Aaron Rabinowitz. We get to whoever gets the vote of two or more becomes our hereditary philosopher king.
Well, shoot, I think you're going to the to prison for life here, man.
I have now advocated, right? So this violates the plain text of 18 U.S.C. section 2385. I have knowingly and willfully advocated overthrowing and destroying the United States government. Why am I so confident that I can do that? First, let me tell you why I'm not confident. confident for two reasons.
Am I cutting that last part?
No, you're going to leave it on. One, I'm going to give the link in the show notes. You can go to 18 U.S.C. 2385, and the law is still on the books. And two, there was a 1950 Supreme Court decision that said that law did not violate the First Amendment. Wow. And this is a callback to, I think it's OA episode number 6, in which I said, please do not. And so I know we've had a lot of new listeners who maybe haven't listened to OA number 6. Please do not use the phrase clear and present danger. Please do not use the illustration of you can't shout fire in a crowded movie theater. Those come from a case called Schenck v. U.S., which is about the suppression of socialist literature. And this case, Dennis v. U.S., is squarely in line with the Schenck line of past precedents, which, although they have not been overruled, they have been had their validity, quote, cast strong doubt upon, right? Mm. They get a red flag in Westlaw and Lexis anyway. Yeah, exactly. Because nobody would cite these cases in a brief today as being good law.
Except Bill Barr.
except maybe Bill Barr. Yeah. So what happened in the Dennis case? I'll go super quickly, but this is a fun story.
I wanted to interject there, like, One of the things that really opened my eyes from doing this show with you was just, I've said it before, but how many of our, what we think of as, these are our constitutional rights, like our right of free speech, our right to an attorney if we're arrested, our, you know, all that kind of stuff, really are like, originate yesterday in historical terms. I mean, to be an originalist, and then I was just thinking as you were saying this, if I remember right, Eugene Debs was imprisoned for like just being a socialist. So this idea that like this country has always had this First Amendment right where so much freedom. No, that's like yesterday that we decided to actually, you know, give a certain amount of rights and freedoms to people.
Let me affirm 100% of what you've said, right? I'm about to read you a horrifying decision from 1951. That is the Dennis v. U.S. case. And it was not effectively overruled until a case called Brandenburg versus Ohio from 1969.
Wow.
By the way, from the height of the Warren Court that people like Bill Barr and 5/9 of our current Supreme Court dismiss as crazy left-wing activist Supreme Court. right? So in other words, the rights you enjoy today are 100% due to having a liberal Supreme Court. Yeah. And if you think the right has forgotten that, you haven't been listening to opening arguments. So yeah, let's go back to the Dennis case because this will make you mad.
Oh, good. I need to be mad. Yeah. I don't have enough currently making me mad.
The Dennis case was about rounding up and arresting the officers of the Communist Party USA, right?
Yeah, wow.
A political organization existing within this country. So 11 people, including they were modeled after the Soviet Union, so their president was called the General Secretary. I'm not a communist, but like I think you should be allowed to be a communist in this country, right? Including one of the 11 people who was arrested was a bona fide war hero, Robert G. Thompson. You could look him up on Wikipedia. I'll give the link in the show notes. But like, seriously, he received the Distinguished Service Cross during World War II. He's a war hero. There was no specific allegation that they were, you know, plotting, right? Right. I mean, they didn't. There's the Communist Party USA. They were talking about like, well, first we're going to have a leaf lettering campaign and then we're going to send, you know, what will eventually be known as sternly worded crunch wraps. Like these were not, this is the 1940s. Right? It was just political speech and they were arrested for being communists. They were sentenced to 5 years in jail. Thompson, by the way, was only sentenced to 3 years in jail in light of his heroism in saving the world from the Nazis. The lawyers representing the defendants were cited for contempt of court and given prison sentences. I was the lawyers repeatedly were cited for contempt of court for engaging in the same advocacy because they were all, you know, left-wing lawyers sympathetic to the causes. I was unable to determine whether they ever served those sentences. So everybody was convicted. It went up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, I am happy to tell you, said that if this were a case where those who claimed protection under the First Amendment were teaching the techniques of sabotage, the assassination of the president, the filching of documents from public files, the planting of bombs, the art of street warfare and the like, I would have no doubts that it's criminal activity. The freedom of speech is not absolute. The teaching of methods of terror and other seditious conduct should be beyond the pale. This case is argued as if those were the facts. The argument imported much seditious conduct into the record. That is easy and has popular appeal. For the activities of communists in plotting and scheming against the free world are common knowledge. But the fact is that no such evidence was introduced at trial. There is a statute that makes seditious conspiracy unlawful. Petitioners, however, were not charged with a conspiracy to overthrow the government. They were charged with a conspiracy to form a party and groups and assemblies of people who teach and advocate the overthrow of our government by force or violence, and with a conspiracy to advocate and teach its overthrow by force and violence. It may well be that indoctrination in the techniques of terror to destroy the government would be indictable under either statute, but the teaching which is condemned here is of a different character. So, great, right? Except that I'm reading from the dissent.
Oh, my God.
Case went 6-2 the other way.
Wow.
That was Harry O. Douglas saying, what are you talking about? You want to criminalize people who plan out terrorist attacks in the United States, go for it. But they're just teaching communism. Like, you can't do that. And that side lost. And that remained the law for 18 years until Brandenburg versus Ohio, which, by the way, Brandenburg was KKK leader.
Yeah, yeah.
And he led a march that said, we want to send African Americans back to Africa. That was not the word he used. And the Jews back to Israel. Quote, we're not a revengeant organization. I love making up a word here. But if our president, our Congress, our Supreme Court continues to suppress the white Caucasian race, it's possible there might have to be some revengeance taken.
And then the court was like, wait, these people need freedom.
Yeah. And That
so it takes the KKK. So if it's lefty, you know, communist types, you're going to jail for even teaching this. But then when the KKK wants to spout, you know, their garbage, you know what? We have a First Amendment. Never mind. Let's give these people rights. It's fascinating how that works to me.
Yep. So, holding of the court. We are confronted here with the statute, which, by its own words and as applied, purports to punish mere advocacy and to forbid, on pain of criminal punishment, assembly with others merely to advocate the described type of action. Such a statute falls within the condemnation of the First and 14th Amendment. So, that is Brandenburg versus Ohio. Thanks, the KKK, for establishing our rights. So even though, and it's why I went through the history on this sort of conduct, because I have seen, and you may see, people on either side citing 18 U.S.C. 2385. It is still on the books, right? Because Brandenburg was not about, it was about a specific Ohio state law, and so not about that federal statute. The court lacks the power to prospectively say, oh, and by the way, we're going to strike down this part of the statute. It is still on the books, so you don't have any way of knowing when you look at it that it's not good law for mere advocacy, but it's not good law for mere advocacy. And that's why I felt comfortable.
Not yet. Until, you know, maybe the Supreme Court takes another crack at it.
So that leaves then the other half, right? The part of the Douglas dissent on sedition that I read, which I want to tell you is still valid law in this country and is the immediately prior section 18 U.S.C. 2384, right? We were talking about 2385 is subversive advocacy. 2384 is sedition. It is very narrow. It prohibits, quote, if two or more persons subject to the jurisdiction of the United States conspire to overthrow, put down, or destroy by force the government of the United States, or levy war against them, or oppose by force the authority thereof, they shall be subject to the same criminal penalties. That is, fines, imprisoned not more than 20 years, or both. That act is on the books, and it is constitutional. Wow. We know that it is constitutional because it has been litigated recently in a case called U.S. versus Rahman, involving Sheikh Oman Abdel Rahman, who was involved in the World Trade Center bombing. He was the co-founder of one of the groups that was a predecessor to various organizations that were then, he was partners with bin Laden, right? Like, look, he's a terrorist.
Yeah.
And he was arrested in connection with plotting the World Trade Center bombing and other terrorist acts.
Fair.
And yep. And one of the things he was charged with was sedition, right? Hmm. Under this precise statute, 18 U.S.C. 2384. And he argued in court that the statute violated the Constitution, that it criminalized free speech, and that it was overbroad and unconstitutionally vague. And and the Second Circuit said, no.
Dude, you bought... You tried to bomb the World Trade Center. It's not really speech.
Right. Yeah.
Bombs aren't speech.
Yeah. And and that's right. It says that these cases make clear a line exists between expressions of belief, which are protected by the First Amendment, and threatened or actual uses of force, which are not.
Right.
That's the line. It's also not vague or overly broad. The court says, we recognize that laws targeting sedition must be scrutinized with care to assure that the threat of prosecution will not deter expression of unpopular viewpoints by persons ideologically opposed to the government. But Section 2384 is drawn sufficiently narrowly that we perceive no unacceptable risk of such abuse. I want to make the strongest case for what your Uncle Frank might be able to say, right? In the Rahman case, the court says the government, possessed of evidence of conspiratorial planning, need not wait until buildings and tunnels have been bombed and people killed before arresting the conspirators. Accordingly, it is well established that the government may criminalize certain preparatory steps towards criminal action, even when the crime consists of the use of conspiratorial or exhortatory words. So, yes, there is a very, very narrow category of speech in which you get together your cellmates and say, here's how we're going to plant bombs at the Capitol, right? Here's how we're going to engage in terrorist activities. And then if they've wiretapped you for other, right, the government can arrest you for that. But I have looked through. I can't say there are 210 cases that cite Section 2384. I've read 30 of them. And I can tell you, with one weird exception involving a guy who is a drug dealer that I can't find anything about. It's a case called U.S. versus Ennis, E-N-N-I-S, from the District of Massachusetts in 2006. So I'll crowdsource that out to OA listeners. And it's a guy named Stephen Nicholson. And I can't, there was another Stephen Nicholson. And I spent like 2 hours down this rabbit trail.
You trying friended to figure him out. On Facebook. Yeah. It was the wrong one.
Well, yeah, I would not friend this guy on Facebook. Okay, so that's the one exception, this guy Stephen Nicholson from 2006. Other than that, the only time this statute has been deployed in modern history has been against terrorists, has been against the 9/11 hijackers and co-conspirators, including Abdallah Higazi, right? Has been against the World Trade Center co-conspirators. In the 1980s, it was against a group called the United Freedom Front, also called the Ohio Seven, which was a left-wing organization that would rob banks and then take the money from robbing the banks to buy bombs to then bomb like Exxon Mobil Exxon headquarters back then, federal buildings. It was mostly property damage that they did, but they did like blow up a federal building with people inside that wounded like 22 people, and some of their officers like killed a police officer at a traffic stop, right? So again, right, we are talking about activities that are an order of magnitude removed and all of the intent removed from protesting, right? Yeah. Even if you're at a protest where somebody, you know, lit a garbage can on fire or graffitied a wall or whatever, like, again, we've been clear on this podcast, don't do that. Those are crimes. That is not the kind of thing. I mean, I read you the decisions here. That is not the kind of thing that remotely rises to the level of conspiratorial planning of the sort that you need to charge somebody with a violation of 18 U.S.C. 2384. So all of that, right? I wanted to go through because it is terrifying that we have an attorney general that is invoking the specter of these things. The invocation is a deterrent. It has a chilling effect. But at the end of the day, there are no district attorneys, no matter how loyal they are to Trump and Barr, that are going to try and bring charges.
So could they go after people aggressively for, say they allege that they, or they have some indication or text or proof that they want to go and do things like, you know, light a garbage can on fire? I mean, I brought up in my excellent brief, my amicus brief, the fact that there's, you know, people in prison serving long sentences for doing almost nothing during protests back in, I think it was during the Ferguson protests, the guy like, you know, lit some trash on fire and is serving an 8-year sentence? I mean, stuff like that. So there is every chance of that kind of prosecution happening, right?
Yes, but this is actually the silver lining, if there is one, in Barr overreaching. Remember, I quoted you his statements that were reported in the Wall Street Journal. Barr was saying, don't go after protesters on things like destruction of property and violating curfew, which, again, those are super easy slam dunk cases to make, right? The law prohibits the kind of conduct.
He was saying, don't do that.
He was saying, don't go after that, but instead go straight for attempting to overthrow the government.
Huh.
Yeah.
That is very weird. I mean,
it's totally bizarre.
Yeah. Normally he's the like competent evil guy, but maybe this time his overreach will be a benefit
Now, I mean, if you want to know why, if you want to know the evil motive for doing that, that is you've now given prosecutors a much bigger stick. And so if you are attempting, and this gets into this is a side effect of the chilling effect deterrence that we've talked about. Remember, right? 99.5% of all criminal cases plead out. Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
what true. You're doing is if the prosecutor comes in with a straight face and says, we've charged you with 18 U.S.C. 2384, violent sedition and overthrow of the United States government, that carries a 20-year prison sentence. Yeah. We want you to plead guilty to X.
It's such an old crap law that I think we can firing squad you if you're guilty of it.
It increasing the severity of the penalties and not including the lesser charges, right? Because if you include the lesser charges, then the lawyers will say, yeah, you don't have a shot in hell on winning on sedition.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've included lighting a mailbox on fire, which carries a $500 penalty or whatever. Well, we'll plead to that one, right?
Mm-hmm.
There is a tactic of overcharging defendants and then saying, yeah, we're not charging you with lighting the mailbox on fire. We're not going for that. So you want to roll the dice in court with 20 years on sedition, or do you want to plead to a year in jail on, you know, this heightened this charge that otherwise we wouldn't be able to prove? So if I wanted to put myself in the dark and terrifying mind of Bill Barr, that's what I would think. But let me emphasize, right, understanding that prosecutorial overcharging happens. The ethics rules, right? These people who are line prosecutors who work for the Department of Justice are bound and required not to bring false charges, right? Not to bring unsupportable charges, charges for which they either know they cannot prove the elements of the crime or lack an articulable basis to say, a good faith basis to say that we should bring these charges. So I'm putting our faith in people.
Silly Andrew.
There are a lot of reasons to think that that's well-founded, right? And we've talked about that on the show a lot, right? Like, we have talked about Brandon Van Grack resigning from the Flynn case when the government said, we want you to file this Rule 48A motion and dismiss everything. And him saying, no, right? Now, you know, we can talk about how much more, you know, how much more courage do you know? Like, we can debate all that back and forth. But I feel like we've highlighted the dangers of Barr making this advocacy. I do not think that it will stick for the reasons that I've described.
Well, try for some optimism there. Appreciate the deep dive. Just a reminder again, maybe when you recognize how much liberal Supreme Courts have done for our rights, maybe we ought to ensure that we get a liberal Supreme Court sometime in the next dozen years or so. We'll see.
That seems like a really great idea. If only there were something we could do.
I know. Yeah. There's, yeah. Alas.
Yeah. No, I'll repeat Eli Bosnick here. We know that you're tired of hearing us say, go vote for Biden and Harris. We're tired of having to say it. But by God, we're going to continue to say it. And I wish it wasn't necessary.
It's just vitally important. It really is.
It just is.
We have to put an end to this madness. And then we'll deal with what comes after that. That doesn't mean everything's solved. You have to put an end to the bleeding. I mean, it's just awful.
And thank you.
And now it's time to thank our new patrons at patreon.com/law. And I'll handle these this time around. Thank you to Brian Coulter, Badal Patel, William Patterson. The flat tires of justice are wobbly. Tires with a Y. Huh.
British listener.
Yeah. Dario Estrabau. Two Gary Johnson voters for Biden because Trump is a threat to the Republic.
There you go.
Congrats.
Hey, we're Thanks making for coming a difference.
Around. Yeah. Jamie Barnett, Brian Farrington, God Puncher, Angus Watt, and Carol. Thank you so much, new patrons. We hope you enjoy. By the way, a lot of movies we had to reschedule. Should have been out, but it'll be out very soon, within a day or two. And we've got a fun one for you. We've got a Keanu Reeves movie. Spoiler, was produced by Dershowitz's son. It's going to be fun. So that's coming at you, patrons, real soon.
We are not doing the Law of Bill and Ted, which would be fun.
That movie has gotten really good reviews. I forgot. I meant to watch that. So people are loving that new Bill and Ted. But anyway,
I did see it. So we could talk about during our review.
We will have that lot off of movies to you, fine patrons, very soon. Thanks so much for pledging.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
It is time for T3BE. I think I might be two in a row. I don't know. I'm doing. Oh, that's right. Now I remember because the music. Yeah, we've gotten good music two times in a row. We'll see if I get to, play some bad music. Do you have any ideas, any Andrew opinions on what the opposite of Chariots of Fire is? Like. any crappy 80s hair metal that's like really dramatic and negative?
I was thinking the opposite of Chariots of Fire is probably AC/DC's Highway to Hell, right?
That's still upbeat though.
Oh no, it's still a great song. Yeah, no, you want, oh, maybe like, I don't know, something by The Cure, like, truly like depressing, everything is awful.
So you mean my preferred music. Okay. Yes, so just look exactly. at any of yeah, my anything preferred from, right. artists.
Yeah. I was trying to think of actual songs that are still good, but yeah, no, if you just want like depressing music that makes you want to kill yourself, like pretty much everything released from 1993 to, 2004. Oh, no,
that's not at all true, but it's definitely my taste. Or how about this? I'll just never get one wrong again. We'll never have to worry about it.
Absolutely perfect. Hoping for more Chariots of Fire. A man and a woman, both purse snatchers, independently entered a grocery store. Each with the intent to steal purses from unsuspecting shoppers. So this is already like a Dirty Rotten Scoundrels kind of...
like a rom-com, I'm thinking.
Yeah, well, I was thinking Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, which is an amazing Steve Martin
I'm thinking
comedy.
They ended up stealing each other's hearts.
Oh, I like it. The man approached a victim, grabbed the strap of the purse that was hanging from her shoulder, and pulled. Okay. The victim screamed and tried to hold onto the purse, but the man knocked her down, causing her to lose her grip on the purse. The man then escaped with the purse. During the commotion that arose when the man's victim screamed, the woman approached the shopping cart of a shopper who had turned towards the noise and wandered away from her cart. The woman reached into the now unattended shopping cart, grabbed the shopper's purse, and quickly walked away, also escaping with the purse.
She's a better purse snatcher. That's a...
Both purse snatchers were apprehended a short while later, so they both suck at their jobs.
Yeah.
Which of the two purse snatchers could properly be convicted of robbery? A, both the man and the woman. B, only the man. C, only the woman. Or D, neither the man nor the woman.
So this is going to be one of those, robbery v. larceny questions. I mean, I think just right off the bat, if I remember correctly, there's no guarantee of that. I'm the opposite of the Princess Bride quote, unless I'm wrong, and I'm always wrong. I think the argument here would be robbery requires some sort of physical altercation type thing or threat of violence or whatever. Whereas the woman in this situation just absconded with the purse, it was a very peaceful operation. And so is that just larceny? Ah, man. So from what I remember, definitionally, it seems like, the man's committed robbery, the woman committed larceny. From what I remember, it still feels weird. And maybe it's just because in common parlance, we use the wrong words, but it's still, if someone said like, I was robbed in the store, no,
you were larced.
Like, yeah. You were larced. Yeah. What, LARPed? No, larced. Yeah. It would take a really big, like, well, actually guy, bold, well, actually reply guy to be like, no, you weren't robbed, you were larced. That would be, but I don't know. Okay. So that's my instinct. That's my memory. I think maybe I should just trust my memory of these definitions and say that only the man can be charged with robbery or convicted of robbery. Maybe there's going to be some, so if I'm trying to narrow down answers as I always do, and I'm usually pretty good at narrowing it down to two, I would say that there's no chance it's only the woman. C, only the woman. I think there's pretty much no chance of D, neither the man nor the woman. Well, let me take a quick check just to make sure. So the man approached a victim, grabbed the strap of the purse, pulled, victim screamed and tried to hold on, but the man knocked her down. Yeah, that's a robbery. So no chance it's D. No chance it's C. Like, that just seems impossible. It definitely could be A somehow. Like, I wonder if there's some, I don't know, some exception, some way that just reaching into a non-attended shopping cart becomes robbery if under certain circumstances, or maybe I'm misremembering the definition. But I'm going to trust what I remember. I'm going to go with B, only the man. Final answer.
All right. I love it when Thomas is super confident. So that should not guide your guesses, but if you in the listening audience would like to play along, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag T3BE. Include your guess, your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and shower that person with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune, not guaranteed.
Yeah, you could boldly go against the guy on a 2-question streak. That's
yeah. I don't know that anybody will take that.
That takes
level of
real
risk.
Courage. Yeah. All right, that's our show. Thanks for listening. I know that was a bit of a bummer, and but that is, wow, we live in a hellscape. We live in a parody of what people thought Trump's America could be. It's even worse, honestly. But that's why we need to stay strong and vote to end the madness in a few short months here. So thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law-talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it would be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.